Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Sunday through Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Who's Reading the Organon, a show co-hosted by Vera Resnick and Debbie Bruck. We're challenging you to join us on our journey to complete Samuel Hahnemann's Organon in 1 year. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, talking with classical homeopath Vera Resnick. Today is June 28, 2010, and you're listening to show number 39 of Who's Reading the Organon. We're going to be reading aphorism number 3 and moving along. We have a lot of exciting things going on in the network and in the political environment for homeopathy today. I think Vera is on the line with us.
Hi, Debbie. Hi, everyone.
Hello, Vera. I'm so happy you're here with us. So I was just saying there's a lot of things going on, and I wanted to start off with a inspiration that comes through Twitter. There's a Twitter profile named Kids Heart Doc, and it's a retweet of Lori Marino, who is a Twitter celebrity. She's got thousands of followers. And one of her quotes is from Yogi Berra. He says, if you don't know where you are going, you'll end up someplace else. And that's a good one for us. We've been talking about reaching our goals and having clear vision, knowing how to practice our art and our skill, gathering tools to practice really as best as we can to heal. And I thought that was a pretty good quote for today.
Okay.
Good. And I wanted to review and reiterate that the news on the HWC network, that we're instituting a new policy, and that is for categorizing our blogs, discussions, and videos, just so that we know exactly what people are reading. Are they reading something that is pertaining exactly to classical homeopathy, to a moderated alternative form of homeopathy, to an alternative healing, just complementary and alternative medicine, which is completely different from homeopathy, and then general news and items of interest. Please take a look at that new article and learn how to do it. It will be a learning curve for all of us to get this new process going. It's going to even be a learning curve for me because I'm not going to be used to doing that extra step to categorize and put it at the top of my blogs and discussions. I would also like people to take a note of Gary Weaver's blog on the new outbreak in California of whooping cough, pertussis, and how do homeopaths deal with this type of an outbreak? Would you consider it at epidemic levels, proportions at this time, or is this isolated incidents? What is the vaccination protocol? How do we use this? Is there a prophylactic for homeopathic use? It's very controversial, and I think we would like to get some more activity going. Okay, and the last bit of political news is regarding the protest at Brighton Center in the UK on June 29th, 2010. So it's at 9 a.m. in the morning. There is only one more day to be activated, and we would really like as many people as possible, if you're living in the UK, to get out there and be part of this protest. Stand up for homeopathy. Make your voice heard. If you're outside of the UK, there are other means that you can protest through blogs, through emails, through letters in your newspaper, your local newspaper, or online internet news. Get out there and get active. Okay, we're going to start with the aphorism number 3 today.
Okay, shall I read, Debbie?
Fantastic.
Okay. Reading from Verica's translation. If the physician clearly perceives what is to be cured in diseases, that is to say, in every individual case of disease, in brackets, knowledge of disease indication, if he clearly perceives what is curative in medicines, that is to say, in each individual medicine, in brackets, knowledge of medicinal powers, and if he knows how to adapt according to clearly defined principles what is curative in medicines to what he has discovered to be undoubtedly morbid in the patient, so that the recovery must ensue, to adapt it as well in respect to the suitability of the medicine most appropriate according to its mode of action to the case before him, choice of the remedy, the medicine indicated, as also in respect to the exact mode of preparation and quantity of it required, proper dose, and the proper period for repeating the dose, if finally he knows the obstacles to recovery in each case and is aware of how to remove them so that the restoration may be permanent, then he understands how to treat judiciously and rationally, and he is a true practitioner of the healing art.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way I see this aphorism, as I see it as defining what Hanuman is setting in front of us through the organon. I see this aphorism as Hanuman presenting the entire structure of the organon to us in this one aphorism. Because basically he's saying, if we clearly perceive what's to be cured in disease, and if you put that, like I'm picturing on the board, the way it would be if I teach it, what's to be cured in disease? If you know what is curative in medicines, so what's to be cured in disease, if you know how to take a case, how to see which symptoms to use, how to work with your individual patient to find out what has the deviation from health been, how do you see what needs to be cured in the patient? If you perceive what is curative in medicines, each individual medicine, knowing the powers of the medicine, how do we know about medicines from proving symptoms and similar? If he knows how to adapt what's curative in medicines to what's morbid in the patient. So that's, first of all, the first connection you need to make between the medicine and what needs to be cured in the patient.
And he did that initially with the proving of cinchona, is that correct?
He did that initially with the proving of cinchona, but he set up, as we'll see further on in the organon, he set up the details for how to prove medicines, how to find out what's curative in a medicine. Now, what's curative in a medicine? When a medicine raises symptoms in a healthy person, then we know that that medicine can relate to those symptoms in a sick person. So this is how we're learning what's curative in medicines.
Mm-hmm. So he's teaching us along with his discoveries. I mean, he's done these provings, and he is now have others who are working along with them to understand what is happening with taking a dose of a remedy that in a crude substance is now a minimal dose, and how the body responds. And he's taking us along on this ride of education and laying it out for us so that we can learn and also use these same principles.
Once we know about diseases and once we know about the medicines, then we need to adapt one to the other. We need to figure out the choice of the remedy. Based on that knowledge, the choice of the remedy is what bridges between the materia medica and the knowledge of disease.
Right, and the materia medica is where we always end up to confirm the choice and the selection of our remedy, even though today we have many repertories to use, rubrics to use. We always have to go back to materia medica and see what's written about a particular remedy, which is based upon the provings and how the individuals respond. So that is our confirmation.
Now, in addition to that, though, we don't just have the choice of the remedy. And this is why I like this aphorism, because it really sets out the story. Knowing the remedy is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know what's the proper dose for the remedy. We need to know how often to repeat the remedy. And we also need to know what the obstacles to recovery would be.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know what could stand in the way of this remedy working.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in previous sessions, we've talked about understanding what the picture is and even drawing the picture and creating this holistic image of understanding the, what's going on with that individual. So that is our clear vision. So Hahnemann says that initially. And not only just understanding the individual case, knowledge, here he's also adding a knowledge of the disease, which is his medical background as a physician. He's got a lot more knowledge behind him, years and years of understanding, of translating medical journals, medical articles. And so his insights are being handed to us through his writings.
I think, Debbie, it's not just his experience as a medical physician. I think also it's his understanding of diseases through chronic diseases, through miasms. There are certain concepts that he's developed in terms of knowledge of disease. And in a way, we can see that knowledge of disease, we'll see as we go through the organon that we can tap back to this concept and know that this comes within the sway, of within the scope of knowledge of disease.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, it's very broad because as we've already read through the latter part of the organon, we've learned about the practical methods and how to do it. So he's introducing this organon, this book, through theory, through philosophy, through metaphor, and just setting the stage for us to begin this learning, the motivation, intention, the knowledge, and the hope that he introduces these basic principles, especially during his day and age of what was being done medically, giving treatments in large crude doses. So he's introducing a really new concept. Today we have the concept of vaccination, of inoculating through small doses. But in his time, they didn't really have that. So these are kind of very new discoveries. And how does he teach us about it? How does he introduce it to us?
Well, I suggest let's just read on and find out more.
Okay.
The subject that he picks up in aphorism 4 is really when he talks about the obstacles to recovery.
Okay.
The issues that derange health. So would you like to read?
Aphorism number 4 says, he is likewise a preserver of health if he knows the things that derange health and cause disease and how to remove them from persons in health. Is there a footnote to that?
No, I think carry on to 5.
Okay. Aphorism number 5. Useful to the physician in assisting him to cure are the particulars of the most probable exciting cause of the acute disease, as also the most significant points in the whole history of the chronic disease, to enable him to discover its fundamental cause, which is generally due to a chronic miasm. In these investigations, the ascertainable physical constitution of the patient, especially when the disease is chronic, his moral and intellectual character, his occupation, mode of living and habits, his social and domestic relations, his age, sexual function, etc., are to be taken into consideration. It's almost like he's laying out for us, what is the tipping point? I mean, this is the verbiage today. It's a big concept that we have of what is it that tips something over into a new realm. And here again, he's saying, what is the exciting cause, the fundamental cause that's going to make a change in that individual from health to illness?
I think we have the issue of an exciting cause. We have the issue of a fundamental cause, like two different things. One is more the trigger for acute disease.
Mm-hmm. So one is acute disease and the other one is the chronic miasm. So he's looking for the cause and he's going to be teaching that to us.
But also here we start having an understanding that we need to ascertain the physical constitution of the patient. We need to find out more about the patient. We need to find out his mode of living, his social and domestic relations. Many of these things really link in directly to aphorism number 4, where we're looking to see if there is any problem that is a maintaining cause, anything that is something that deranges health and causes disease. For example, I was treating someone before I worked as a homeopath. I was treating someone whose job was to work in huge freezers. He worked with packing meats, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So he had constant upper respiratory problems, sometimes even to the extent of needing hospitalization.
Okay. So here is this is a maintaining cause. This is the initial exciting cause. This is the fundamental cause.
So here, this is something that deranges health.
Okay.
When you spend 8 hours a day inside an industrial freezer, that deranges health.
Right.
And there, at some point, the patient has to decide, does he want health or does he want this particular job? And it's a very, very difficult decision to make.
Mm-hmm.
I think today's example probably would be mostly the shift workers, people who work doing telemarketing and who work nights. And there are so many studies showing how working the whole way through the night deranges health. And for us, I think, as homeopaths, it's a huge dilemma, because it's almost as if a patient comes to us and says, I'm going to destroy myself every day and I want you to patch me up.
Mm-hmm. I think that this is ongoing in all generations, not just this generation, because back then, I'm sure a great deal of ill health was due to poor sanitation, and mm-hmm. that was a maintaining cause, an obstacle to cure, an etiology, exciting cause for it. There was a lot of, due to this poor sanitation, malaria and transfer of viral disease, bacterial disease. And also, as you say, today we're in a place where there's a lot of depression, not just mental, emotional depression, economic depression. It's a connection between having unemployment, no job. I mean, this is a really good point. I am absolutely amazed that the people in the Gulf still want to drill oil wells, even though they're looking at the total destruction of their environment and their health, and yet they still want to keep a job. Obviously, for your survival, you need to make a living. So it is a dilemma for everyone. And how do we solve these types of problems? Even if we were able to give a remedy to people who were sick due to their environment or the living conditions, if they're still in that same poor condition, what will happen? How can we alleviate it as a permanent cure?
I think that a lot of what this aphorism relates to is how we need to see what we can do and where there's something we can do and where we do what we can but can't do more than that. I mean, for example, if you have a patient who's in an abusive marriage,
mm-hmm.
with an abusive spouse, and you give that patient remedies for tension or for various physical ills, but you know that as you send your patient back into his home life or her home life, the whole cycle will just start again, and the sickness is part of that cycle. So
right.
It comes to a point where we need to see the extent and understand the extent of what we can do.
Well, this is a combination of things, because in the example that you've given, if we can get to the exciting cause, the fundamental cause, and it's a emotional connection within relationships, within having to do with their job, maybe the person will become enlightened about their health and take the proper steps, whether it is to move to a new location, to move their family, or to change the situation, the relationship in their marriage by getting counseling, by actually improving their communication skills with the spouse, or possibly getting a divorce. I mean, it depends on what the situation is. For a child, it's much more difficult because there's no way out for them. They have to learn how to cope until they're old enough to be mobile and become independent. So I think homeopathic care really delves into a deeper level of understanding of the cause and people, not just a surface approach of what is the outside environment, but what is the internal environment within the human being that sets up this trigger for disease?
It's complicated.
Yes, it is a very complicated.
Yes,
yes it is. So you're saying that we have, as a homeopath, we need to understand our limitations, what we can or are able to do for an individual depending upon their life circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But we also need to be able to see as clearly as we can how far we can go to help that person.
Right.
Okay. Do we want to go to the footnote?
There's no footnote on that. Let's go to aphorism 6, and we'll do what we can before our time is up.
Okay. Go ahead and
okay.
You can read it.
Okay, so I'll read it. The unprejudiced observer, well aware of the futility of transcendental speculations, which can receive no confirmation from experience, be his powers of penetration ever so great, takes note of nothing in every individual disease except the changes in the health of the body and of the mind, morbid phenomena, accidents, symptoms, which can be perceived externally by means of the senses. That is to say, he notices only the deviations from the former healthy state of the now diseased individual, which are felt by the patient himself, remarked by those around him, and observed by the physician. All these perceptible signs represent the disease in its whole extent. That is, together, they form the true and only conceivable portrait of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my recommendation, this aphorism is so crucial to case-taking because in this aphorism, Hahnemann presents to us what we should look for when we are taking a case and presents to us what is the most important part of the case-taking that we're about to do.
Mm-hmm.
I would underline the word, the changes in the health of the body, that word changes. This is what we're looking for. We're looking for what has changed. And subsequent to that, he says, which can be perceived externally by means of the senses. Here he's talking of the five senses, not the six.
Right.
Changes which can be perceived externally. What we smell, what we hear, we touch the patient's hand. We touch the patient's forehead, the senses.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure how taste comes in here, although I have heard tricks played on medical students using urine samples. But we're looking at the senses. You look at your patient. You touch, you smell, you see, you hear. You hear what has changed. This is crucial because sometimes in case taking, what happens is we get lost. We get lost in 20 years ago. We get lost in 30 years ago. And we become bewildered, especially when it's an older patient and a long story. That's my experience, at least. But if we focus on what has changed now, and then gradually we'll work our way back in the life of our patient as each stage becomes visible to us through the tracking, through the remedies that we're giving.
Mm-hmm. But there is something that we've learned in the never well since, which could be something from a past that could be stay with them for years and years, and mm-hmm. they just repeat the same thing. I've not been well since, and then this accident or this disease or this illness, whatever it might be. And we can look into the past as it displays itself in the present form.
For sure, we're looking into the past, but we're looking into the past on the level of what changed. I was healthy, I am now not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
What changed? When you became unhealthy, did you become cold when you were hot before?
Mm-hmm.
Did you become thirstless when you were thirsty before? What changed?
Yes, and he indicates both the body and the mind.
Yes, very definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us very much into this sphere of how you can have people who, when they were healthy, they were quite unpleasant people. And when they got sick, they became very pleasant. And then one of the things that will happen with a remedy is that our docile, pleasant, sick person will become a quarrelsome, difficult, well person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way things are.
That's really very, very interesting. So even, for instance, like a Staphylococcus aureus, their countenance is that they are pleasant to be around, and yet there's an inner anger that's within them. So that there's a change that has occurred so that you don't perceive on the outside this anger because they're showing the side of themselves that is, they don't want to show that angry. aspect of themselves to the public.
It reminds me, there was a kid who I was treating, a 13-year-old, I think he was, 12 or 13 at the time. He was having very bad stomach aches that he had to bend forward when he had these stomach aches, cutting sudden, very sharp cramping. And it turns out there's a history of humiliation. There's a difficult history. And he was the youngest of a large family. And I gave colocentis and I warned the mother.
Mm-hmm.
I said, try and let the other kids not squash him for the next few weeks because he is going to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And he was. He was. He let all the argumentativeness in him out. He was really fighting back then, but the remedy was helpful to him.
May I ask on this particular example how it refers back to what we were talking about yesterday in terms of dealing with pain and suffering and whether you have to go through that part of healing? Because that was something that I didn't bring out in yesterday's discussion, but I do think that it is part of the overall scheme of things.
You see, I don't know. I think that the concept of you have to go through pain and suffering for healing, I think it's a very cultural concept. And I think different cultures view that differently.
But you just explained that to the parent, to the family. You know, this little kid, he's going to be going through this transformation.
Oh, he wasn't going to be going through pain. His family was going to be going through pain because he was going to
do what? He was going to express himself and
express all the anger he had bottled up in him.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't going to be a painful experience for him. It was a painful experience for his family because for once in their life, they were under instructions not to squash him,
mm-hmm.
not to humiliate him, not to restrict him, but just to let him express himself.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And he did.
Very interesting.
And you could say part of the family's healing in this case was to go through pain and suffering. I don't know.
That is a really fascinating, interesting approach to enable somebody to get through their healing process just by the other people around him being observers rather than getting into their thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
Not to repress or suppress or constrict or whatever it is that's going on in that family dynamic, but allowing someone to just be until they can clear out this morbid phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Give ourselves an umbrella statement for aphorism number 3. Did we do 3, 4, 5?
We did 3, 4, 5. I don't really have, and 6. But we haven't finished 6. We still have the footnote. We really do have to close, so
okay.
I think we'll just say goodbye.
Okay, until next time.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Who's Reading the Organon with homeopaths Vera Resnick and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio. Remember to take the Organon off the shelf and read it.